cops. It's him. Maybe they were motioning frantically for someone to trace the call, telling Dick to act natural. He could feel his heart in his throat, nearly hung up.
Hey!
Dick sounded cheerful when he answered. Too cheerful. It was probably a trap. They knew.
Hey yourself,
he said, trying to keep his voice steady.
How'd it go today? We found the girl alive. She's in shock but unharmed. That's amazing. You're telling me. I was sure it was going to end up with another body. This is one of those rare days that it's good to be a cop. Want to celebrate with some steak?
He asked, stopping himself from asking the question on the tip of his tongue. Did she see his face?
Nah, sorry, I'm exhausted. I spent the whole goddamn day securing the scene. Next week? Sure. So the girl's all right. Yeah, doesn't remember a thing, though. I guess it's shock. Doctors say it's possible the memories might return later.
He shut his eyes. Dick could be stringing him along. But he was such a bad liar. He remembered that time they'd thrown a surprise party for Dick's wife. He hadn't been able to stop fidgeting the entire day.
Here's hoping, he said, realizing he'd let the silence stretch out. I'm holding on to that promise for steak, okay? If you bring the beer, don't I always?
Dick laughed.
See you, man. Bye.
His palms were sweating as he put the phone on the table. Was he really off the hook? For now, apparently he was. But it was only a matter of time. The girl might remember, or they'd match the tire tracks at the burial site to his van, or they'd figure out he'd been tipped off about the search, start questioning everyone, asking who they talked to, and Dick would say no one. Who would I tell? Oh, right, I remember, it's probably nothing, but... He unfurled his left fist, the torn, crumpled pieces from the list of experiments still in it. He wanted to go on. How many more experiments would he manage before they got him? 2, 3, 5, 1? He had to make it count. Item 20 on the list was his masterpiece, the one that would nail his spot in the pages of history. He could afford to skip a few. He'd have to buy a signal booster for it to work, but he'd already done his research. He knew where to get it so it would be delivered the next day. And maybe this time, he could take the one victim who could really turn him into a legend. Chapter 70. San Angelo, Texas. Monday, September 12th, 2016. The constant noise in the police station on Monday morning reminded Tatum of an angry swarm of bees. If bees constantly drank coffee, shouted instructions on the phone and walked briskly down corridors muttering to themselves. There was a definite sense that stuff needed to get done, and if you weren't getting things done, you'd better make damn sure you found something to get done, or at least look like you were getting something done. As far as Tatum could see, the entire police force was now tasked with finding Schrodinger's killer. Petty thieves, abusive husbands, drug dealers, and drunk drivers all got the day off from police scrutiny, free to break the law at leisure. Because unless you happened to bury women alive, the San Angelo police didn't care. Officially, Jensen was in charge of the operation, but a tectonic shift was transpiring. The Texas Department of Public Safety had joined the circus. Texas Rangers roamed the division. And one of them, a gray-haired, stocky man, was slowly taking control of the investigation. Jensen appeared helpless against the sudden coup. Tatum guessed they'd have a day or two at most until DPS would be formally in charge. Meanwhile, Foster was the one who actually called the shots. He assigned people to go through security cam footage, interview witnesses who had seen Juliet the night of the party, go through social media profiles of possible future victims, and do whatever else occurred to him. They had no morning meeting, no time to talk. It was time to do. Talking could come later. And besides, Jensen was distracted because there was a press conference at 9 in the morning, and the DPS major intended to join him. The citizens of San Angelo, and in fact the rest of Texas, all wanted to hear about the brilliant police operation that had led to the rescue of the beautiful and heroic Juliet Beach. Those were actual words Tatum had heard on the radio that morning. Beautiful and heroic. Tatum found it hard to concentrate. His desk was opposite Foster's, and every few minutes someone would approach Foster, often leaning on Foster's desk, and thus pointing their ass toward Tatum as they reported their findings or asked a question. The narrow passageway between the desks guaranteed that the said backsides were often inches from Tatum's head. He'd seen a plethora of rear ends that morning, of all kinds and shapes. That was not a position he enjoyed. He gritted his teeth as yet another bum was pointed at him, this one belonging to a uniformed cop, and continued reading through the crime scene report. This time, they had a lot more to work with. Juliet Beach had been buried inside a box almost identical to the previous boxes. A metal contraption was placed in one corner, with the drawing of a skull and crossbones, the supposed acid container. It was empty and wasn't wired to anything. A prop, just like Zoe had intuited. Tatum saw the twisted sense in it. The so-called experiment involved constantly turning the feed on and off, leaving the viewers in suspense when the feed was offline. But there wouldn't be enough suspense without an imminent threat. Several dents and scratches marred the box's wooden lid. One dent was 0.6 inches deep, and its shape indicated a heavy tool with a blunt rectangular edge, which didn't match the shovels the police had used to dig up the box. The tool had nearly gone through the lid, which was just over an inch thick. Tatum imagined the murderer, a shadowy, faceless man slamming the heavy tool at the lid, trying to smash it to kill Juliet Beach before the police could get to her. As in the previous instances, they found no fingerprints, hairs, fabrics, or anything similar on the box's exterior. The interior was filled with fingerprints, broken fingernails, blood, and skin cells, all probably belonging to the victim. It had all been sent to the lab. They'd found track marks in the sand, and some were fairly recent. They'd matched a portion of the tracks to similar markings found at Nicole Medina's crime scene. The cable that ran up from the infrared camera in the box was unclipped this time, protruding from the sand. They'd found a single fingerprint on the plastic plug. It had been checked against APHIS, the automated fingerprint identification system, but the print was partial and smudged, and they'd found no match. Contrary to popular belief, fingerprinting wasn't a magical method of identification. Given a good fingerprint or two, the system could spit a long list of possible matches after a couple of hours, but there was only so much it could do with a smudge. The database was just too large. Still, Tatum mentally noted this. He had an idea that he wanted to check later. The box had been buried about 3 feet below the surface. Underneath it was a hollow space that had caved in. This was the reason the killer hadn't been able to bury Juliet as deep as before, and this lucky happenstance was the only reason Juliet was still alive. There were several photographs of the crime scene. Tatum wished that someone had taken a photograph before they'd begun digging. But of course, their attention had been elsewhere. Even Zoe didn't grumble about it this time. The location was a bit more remote than before, in a large field of fenced private land. The killer had presumably opened the unlocked gate in the fence to drive through. Numerous fingerprints on the gate had been matched to the officers who'd opened it and to the owner. The tire tracks of the killer's vehicle led to a different portion of the fence, which had been cut with wire cutters. No fingerprints anywhere. How close had they been to catching him? Tatum couldn't dislodge the could-haves, should-haves, and if-onlys that always followed moments like these. He let himself drift on a daydream in which they'd thought to set up roadblocks on Burma Road. The serial killer had been caught, and the San Angelo citizens were throwing a parade in there. A set of buttocks brushed his shoulders.
Oops, sorry,
the young detective apologized, shifting a bit closer to Foster's desk. Tatum got up and strode outside. Somehow the baking sun was better than the air-conditioned chaos inside the station. He took out his phone and dialed the one and only Sarah Lee, his private analyst.
Tatum, I'm not your private analyst, she said as she answered the phone. I have actual important work here.
That's what I admire about you, the way you manage to multitask all those different things. And on top of that, to take care of a dog. How is Grace, by the way?
Grace is fine, Tatum. She tried to hide the smile in her voice, quite unsuccessfully. What do you want?
I have a fingerprint.
I'd say you have 10. That's how fingerprints usually work.
It's from a crime scene.
Run it against APHIS and you'll have your results in no time.
It's a crap fingerprint. APHIS can't match it.
What do you want from me?
You remember the Klaus case back in L.A.? It was about 3 years ago.
She took a second to recall it.
Oh yeah, bank robbery, right?
Right. We had 2 partial fingerprints, and you did some magic incantation and got a match to a similar crime.
It wasn't a magic incantation.
You mixed it in your witch's cauldron.
Tatum.
and added a newt's eye and some pixie dust, and then opened your spell book.
That's not how it went.
And spoke the magic words.
I just ran it against a much smaller database.
Well,
Tatum grinned.
It felt like magic to me. Can you do it with my fingerprint?
She sighed. What I did then was run it against fingerprints found at other robbery crime scenes in the area in the previous 3 months. And even then, you might remember, I got a bunch of false matches.
And one true match,
Tatum pointed out. Okay, fine.
Can you run my fingerprint against crimes in Texas from the last 10 years?
That's your definition of small? She asked. I'd never get a match like that.
Okay.
He hesitated.
Make that the past 3 years. And just San Angelo.
She didn't sound thrilled. It's going to take a bit of work. And you know, I do have people I actually need to do stuff for.
But none of them are as charming as I am.
You'd be surprised. Let me see what I can do.
Thanks, Sarah. You're the bee's knees.
Yeah, yeah. She hung up. Smiling, Tatum slid the phone into his pocket. He nipped inside and sent Sarah the image file of the smudged fingerprint. Then, not wanting to endure the ongoing butt parade, he decided he could go grab a coffee and a sandwich somewhere nearby. Sarah's email landed in his inbox just as he returned to the station's parking lot. He read it on his phone, leaving the engine on for the sake of the air conditioning. There was a possible match to 7 crime reports. 3 gang-related shootings, 2 break-ins, 1 auto theft, and 1 rape. There were no details on the files, just names and local case file numbers. He walked inside and crouched over Foster's desk, pointing his own butt at the back of his empty chair.
I have some possible matches to the fingerprint, he said. One is a rape. Seriously?
Foster tensed.
Do you have a name? Derek Woodard.
Foster's shoulder sagged.
That asshole. He's in prison. We got him for a series of sexual assaults. He targeted old pensioners.
Damn. Tatum ignored the twinge of disappointment in his mind.
Well, I have 6 other matches here. Let's see them.
They went over the list, checking the case file numbers. 3 more were incarcerated. 1 was dead, and 1 had been shot in his back and was now in a wheelchair. The only 2 remaining cases were the auto theft and 1 of the break-ins. Although no one had been caught in the auto theft crime, it involved 3 perpetrators who'd broken one of the car's windows and taken the car for a ride, finally leaving it discarded all of its tires flat outside San Angelo. It had happened 9 months before, and Tatum couldn't think of a crime that was less likely to involve their killer. The other, which Tatum thought was a break-in, was just an attempted break-in of a local gas station 4 months before. A window had been smashed, and once the alarm had sounded, the perpetrator had fled. This wasn't likely to be related either, but the case file did note that the unknown person had been caught on the security camera trying to break in. The actual footage was missing. The fingerprints didn't hit a relevant match on APHIS.
I'll go have a look, Tatum said. I can send someone over, Foster answered. You don't need to trouble yourself.
Tatum glanced around him, the busy, angry hum feeling almost unbearable.
It's okay. I could use a break.
Chapter 71. The gas station was on the outskirts of San Angelo, and only 1 other vehicle was there when Tatum parked his car. A woman stood by the pumps fueling her car while 3 children sat in the back seat. She seemed tired to the point of exhaustion and ignored her kids as they made faces at her through the back window. Tatum smiled at her, trying to convey sympathy, and entered the station store. A thin man stood behind the counter, and as Tatum approached him, he let out a hiccup. Tatum pulled out his badge.
Agent Gray, FBI. I wanted to ask you about the...
Tatum blinked. The hiccup had been somewhat violent and had broken his train of thought.
I wanted to ask you about the attempted... Sorry, do you want a drink of water? No,
the man said.
It could help with your hiccups. It won't. Right.
Tatum slung his thumbs through the belt.
I wanted to ask you about the attempted break-in that happened 4 months ago. Did you work here back then? Yes. I understand that the man who tried to break in was caught on camera.
Yes. The man gestured at a screen that was split to 4, displaying the security feeds of the gas station's cameras. Two displayed the inside of the store. One showed the front door. The fourth was aimed at the gas pumps. Tatum saw the woman outside on the screen. She had finished filling the gas tank and stared into space as her kids took turns mashing their faces against the window.
"Can I see the footage?"
The man raised an eyebrow.
"It was a long time ago. The computer only retains footage a month back." "And you didn't save a copy of that film?"
Tatum asked incredulously.
"No. Why would I?" "The man wore a mask."
"What kind of mask?"
"A ski mask? It hit his face almost completely. He broke that window over there."
The man pointed at a window near the door.
"Then the alarm started, and he ran. Not much of a movie."
Tatum kept waiting for the next hiccup, feeling a strange tension coiling inside him. The man met his eye calmly. The hiccups were apparently gone.
"Can you tell me? Are you sure you don't want a drink of water? It really helps with hiccups." "It won't help me."
"Why not?"
"I've been hiccuping for a while now."
"Maybe drinking water would fix that."
"It didn't fix it for the past 4 years."
"You've been hiccuping for 4 years?
"Yes, and drinking water didn't help. You know what else didn't help? Holding my breath and drinking water from an upside-down glass and being surprised or frightened and biting a lemon and helpful suggestions by FBI agents. I'm sorry. I don't like hiccuping. It doesn't help my sex life. It wakes me up at night, so I'm tired, which makes me hiccup even more. Also, some people think it's funny."
The man eyed Tatum suspiciously.
"I don't think it's funny,"
Tatum said, feeling a bit guilty.
"Anyway, there's no footage, but I watched it several times. Just a guy with a mask and gloves. He broke the window with a hammer, then ran."
"Gloves?" Tatum asked, surprised.
"I thought there was a fingerprint." "There was,"
he indicated the window.
"He wore latex gloves and they tore when the window was broken, so we got a fingerprint on the glass."
Tatum nodded, distracted. It didn't sound like their guy.
"Thanks, and good luck with the—"
"Yeah."
He left the store, the blazing heat hitting him straight in the face. For a moment, his eyes adjusting to the bright light outside, he could almost imagine he'd walked into the middle of a desert. Across the road, he could see nothing but a flat expanse of sand, spotted with cacti and numerous rocks. He frowned, then looked behind him. The security camera was easily visible above the automatic glass door, and looking from where he stood, it was impossible to tell its exact angle. He turned back to the large, empty field, then glanced at the camera. He had a crazy idea. Pulling his phone, he dialed Zoe.
"Are you near the map?"
"Yes."
"Can you check something for me? I'm at a gas station on Route 67, about a mile outside San Angelo's south side. Can you see if it's one of our easy digging spots?"
"Hang on." He waited, feeling as if he was wasting his time and hers along with it. "Yes, it's in one of those areas," she finally said. "Why?"
"Well, there's a gas station here, and there was a break-in attempt 4 months ago. The fingerprint they found in the crime scene yesterday might match the one here. The security camera above the front door looks like it's aimed straight at the area across the road."
A second passed as Zoe processed this. "You think the unsub tried to break into the gas station to destroy the security footage?"
"That's what I had in mind. I mean, if he suspected the camera caught him killing someone. What do you think?"
"He's pretty careful. But if it was an early killing, he would have been very agitated. It could spur him to react fast, like he did yesterday, trying to dig up Juliet to kill her. It's the same reaction, a sudden gut fear that prods him into a risky maneuver. I can see it happening."
"Right,"
Tatum said, encouraged.
"I hope that guy with the cadaver dog isn't busy. I've got a job for him."
Chapter 72. It took Shelley, the cadaver dog, less than 10 minutes to home in on a spot deep in the field, half hidden from the road by a few dry shrubs and cacti. Once there, the dog paused, scratched the earth and whined, and Victor looked at him and said,
"She found something, all right."
This time there was absolutely no urgency, and they did it right. The crime scene technicians showed up and set up a crime scene tape and a wide, three-walled screen to hide the excavation from the road. Several cops were dispatched to stop any curious onlookers or journalists from getting near. And the grave was dug carefully, while Tatum and Victor watched, soon joined by Zoe and Foster. The entire crime scene was filling with cops and rangers, and Curly had already shown up as well, standing by Tatum's side, waiting for the remains.
"Second body in 5 days," Victor said sadly.
"Third for me," Curly said.
"This city never used to be so violent back in the day," Victor muttered.
"Yeah, it's a terrible business."
Tatum glanced down at the dog, who was sniffing at his shoe.
"Your dog. Shelley is amazing at what she does."
"She really is,"
Victor sniffed.
"Saw that Jones and Buster were on the front page of the San Angelo Standard Times with that girl Juliet."
"Jones and Buster?"
Tatum asked, confused.
"Oh, that guy with the dog who found her? Yeah, it was a nice picture."
"It was."
The officers got out of the grave one by one, and then one of them leaned forward into the hole and yanked the lid. All of them turned away, grunting in disgust. Victor sighed again and shook his head.
"Come on, Shelley, let's go write our report."
The canine officer left, and Tatum approached the grave, Zoe already 2 steps ahead of him. This one was definitely different. For one, these remains were much older. The body had suffered from insect activity, and putrefaction was very advanced. The insects could reach her easily, since the box was not as well made as the previous ones, and there were thin gaps between the planks. The box was square, not rectangular, more like a crate. The skeletal body was curled inside in a fetal position. If this girl had been buried alive like this, her death must have been even worse than the other victims, with her body forced into this unnatural position just so he could fit her into the box. Tatum turned away, feeling sick. In the background, he heard some muttering from people around him. "No camera," Zoe said dryly. Tatum felt a flash of anger, and he wasn't sure if he was angry at himself for not seeing it, or at Zoe's ability to notice such a detail when faced with such a horrid scene. He forced himself to look again and saw she was right. The box was as plain as could be. Perhaps its original use had been to contain fruits or vegetables. No infrared camera was located inside, or a hole through which the cable could be fitted.
"Excuse me."
Curly shouldered his way through.
"We'll need to lift the box out," Foster told him. "No room for you in the pit. Just take care not to spill dirt into the box while you dig."
They ended up closing the box before they commenced digging again, freeing it from the soil. Tatum took a few steps aside, watching them. He'd followed a threadbare lead, and it had ended up leading them to another dead girl. He was anything but victorious. "That's his first victim," Zoe said, joining him by his side.
"You sure?"
She shrugged. "Can't be sure of anything. But it looks like it. Just the basic fantasy. Bury a girl alive. He didn't even have a box in the right size. The location is far from perfect. Too close to the city. Not well hidden. He was lucky no one saw him."
"He probably buried her at night. It must have been pitch dark."
"Yeah, but still. There are markings of inexperience everywhere. Then once he was done and had his sexual relief, he became focused enough to notice the gas station. And he began wondering."
"About the security cameras."
"He was worried that the cameras might have caught him. He put on a ski mask and some gloves. I'm guessing he had both of those handy, and he tried to break inside to destroy the footage."
"The camera isn't even aimed at this area," Tatum said. "What a dumb asshole."
"Right." Zoe raised her eyebrow, clearly surprised at his angry tone. "He isn't dumb anymore. He had plenty of time to think about his mistakes and to avoid making them again." Tatum nodded, not wanting to debate it. He was tired of analyzing the killer, trying to get into his head. For once, he just wanted to think of him as a monster, a vile, evil creature that couldn't be explained, that should be hunted with pitchforks and torches and destroyed. "He might have a link to the victim," Zoe added. "Maybe he lived close to her. Maybe she was an acquaintance. If we figure out that link, we might catch him.
Maybe.
Tatum grunted. Perhaps sensing his mood, Zoe walked away, probably trying to imagine what the killer had seen that night. By tomorrow, she'd have a perfect picture of how the event of that night had taken place. The officers managed to pry the box out of the pit, and Curly approached it, instructing them to be careful. He opened the lid, his hands gloved, and leaned into the box, inspecting the body. Tatum imagined him taking the skeleton's pulse to determine if it was really dead, and let a humorless smile stretch his lips. Curly pulled out a small purse and handed it to Foster without a word. Tatum stepped forward, feeling curious. Foster opened the purse and took a cursory glance at it.
Some money here. $40 in change. A crumpled bus ticket. Ah, there's the driver's light.
His mouth went slack, eyes widening, filling with surprise and pain.
What is it?
Tatum asked.
I know this woman,
Foster croaked.
She. We went to school together. Deborah Miller. Oh, shit. I'm sorry. She was so lovely,
Foster said.
Everyone adored her, but she left town after school. Pretty sure I heard she moved to California.
Tatum said nothing, watching as Curly examined the body. Despite her supposed move to California, this woman had ended up in a crate, buried under the soil of her hometown. Chapter 73 Zoe joined Lyons to notify Deborah's parents. Why tag along? Lyons asked her on the way. There's literally nothing harder in this job than notifying family. Do you like suffering? Zoe wasn't sure if Lyons meant to ask if she liked to suffer or if she enjoyed other people's suffering. But the answer was the same in any case. No, I don't. But people reveal a lot when their guard is down. This is the worst kind of notification, Lyons muttered. We don't need to give them the gory details, Zoe pointed out. Especially since we don't know. That's not what I mean. Yeah, sure, notifying parents about a violent death is terrible. But it's even worse when we don't know if it's her for sure. Oh. Right. Zoe knew what Lyons meant. They would tell Deborah's parents that they found her body, but then they'd ask if there was anything to assist in verifying it was her, because of the body's decomposed state. And then, as predictable as the sun in the morning, hope showed its ugly head. Maybe it's not her, the parent would point out. You could be wrong. Suddenly they saw a lifesaver they could cling to in this terrible storm of grief and loss. They'd refuse to entertain the almost certain outcome that no, it wasn't a pickpocket who had stolen their daughter's purse and then gotten killed. It was their daughter all along. Which only meant they'd end up being notified twice. The first time when the body was found, and the second when its identity was confirmed. They parked next to a house painted in a cheerful white and yellow, a nice green picket fence surrounding the yard. But as they got out of the car and walked to the front door, Zoe noticed signs of neglect everywhere. Wilting flowers in the garden, surrounded by weeds. Grimy windows. Peeling wall paint. She could hear the faint buzz of flies all around her. Lyons knocked on the door, then knocked again.
Just a minute,
a man said from inside. They waited for what seemed like much more than a minute, and just when Lyons was about to knock again, the door opened. The man who opened it was bald, his face crinkled and weary. He wore a stained white shirt. On first glance, Zoe guessed his age to be around 80, and then she realized he was younger than that, probably not much more than 60, but he seemed like a man whose life had worn him down. Mr. Miller, Lyons said.
Yeah?
I'm Detective Lyons. Can we come in? His shoulder slumped.
Is this about Deborah?
It's better if we discuss this inside. He folded his arms.
How much trouble is she in?
Lyons hesitated. Sir, it might be best if you sit down for this. His eyes widened.
Is she hurt?
Lyons sighed, clearly deciding they weren't about to be invited inside. Mr. Miller, I'm afraid that Deborah is dead.
Dead?
The word came out as a whisper. We believe so, yes, sir.
You
Believe.
There it was. Hope.
You aren't sure.
We're reasonably sure. We found a body with your daughter's driver's license in its purse.
Does she look like my daughter?
Lion swallowed. The body is in bad shape. We believe she was murdered 4 months ago.
4 months ago?
The hope seemed to evaporate.
That's quite accurate.
When was the last time you saw your daughter? Lyons asked. Mr. Miller took a shuddering breath.
Well, last time was around the beginning of May.
Zoe and Lyons exchanged looks. The gas station had been broken into on May 6th. Mr. Miller turned around and scuffled inside, leaving the door open. Zoe and Lyons followed him. The house had a cold and abandoned feeling to it. Dust and dirt were everywhere. The lights were turned mostly off, the curtains drawn, leaving just enough light to walk without stumbling into something. Miller shuffled to the kitchen and turned on a neon lamp that hummed noisily, glowing with a white, hostile light. He slumped onto a chair by a small, peeling wooden table. There were two other chairs, and Zoe sat in one, letting Lyons take the other.
You say she was murdered. Who did it? How?
He asked, his voice raspy, his eyes gleaming wet. We don't know the details yet, Lyons said.
What do you know?
4 months ago, you saw your daughter. And you haven't talked to her since, Zoe said softly, ignoring the question. Why didn't you report her missing?
We thought she just left.
He shook his head.
She was always disappearing for months at a time, showing up unannounced, looking like hell. We knew she was using. Sometimes she had a black eye or a swollen lip. But she always said she was fine. Refused to give us any details. Sometimes she'd call from jail. I went to bail her out 3 times.
He let out a long, hopeless groan. A tear materialized and ran down his cheek.
She'd been the sweetest, happiest kid when she was at school. So popular, surrounded by friends. When school ended, she just got lost. She started working a minimum wage job at the nearby cinema. Didn't want to go to college. Began smoking. We didn't know what to do. Then she announced she was going to California, that she found a marvelous job opportunity there. We were so relieved. But she stopped calling after a while, and when she showed up next, it was easy to see that a good job was the furthest thing from her life.
He looked at the wall, his eyes white, empty and quivering, tears rolling from them steadily, following each other in the grooves of his face.
The men in her life were the ones who destroyed her. I'm sure of it. They say a girl learns how a man behaves from her father. But I never laid a hand on her, I swear.
Some women find the wrong men despite their parents, Zoe said. She wasn't trying to comfort him, just pointing out a flaw in his reasoning. But he smiled at her sadly.
Was it one of them who did it?
He asked. We don't know yet, Lion said. Do you have any names?
None. She always said she was done with them. I'd ask who gave her that bruise or broke her finger, and she'd say it didn't matter, that she was done with them for good. I don't know if she always returned to the same guy, or if she really ditched them every time. Finding others just as bad.
And what happened the last time you saw her? Lyons asked.
She showed up a day before, looking worse than ever. Thin. Broken. Do you ladies have children?
They both shook their heads.
You have no idea how it feels to have your child show up like that. And Martha and I decided that this time, she wasn't going to just disappear with some money in her hand. No, we were going to save her.
He snorted, then hid his face in his palms, shaking. A clock hung on the wall of the kitchen and it ticked. Zoe could almost swear the seconds were slowing down, each longer than the last. Finally, he removed his hands. His face was a mess.
We told her she had to stay, that we were taking her to rehab, to therapy. We were going to help her get better. She said she didn't need that. She shouted at us that she didn't need our help, that she was leaving forever this time.
I said some things I shouldn't have. Oh, God, the things I told her. If you ever have children, never show them your disappointment in how they turned out.
Zoe wished Tatum were there. He always seemed to know what to say to make people feel better.
She left, and we didn't hear from her again. We thought she'd return like she always did, but she didn't. And then Martha died a month ago. She just died. Her heart stopped working. It broke, I guess.
He folded his arms.
And that's it.
Lyons asked him questions, tried to get a better idea of where she'd gone, if she'd had any friends she'd get in touch with, anything at all. But Deborah's father's answers became shorter and shorter all the way to monosyllabic words and then nothing at all. Finally, after Lyons ascertained he didn't need any help, he gave her the name of Deborah's dentist, who could probably assist in verifying it really was her body. And then he shut down completely, like a toy that had run out of batteries. Chapter 74. San Angelo, Texas. Thursday, May 5th, 2016. He pushed the door and walked into the pub, sat on a stool, jaw clenched in anger. This was how every day ended, his entire body clenched tight as if about to explode. It only became bearable after a few beers. For the past few days, he'd begun drinking earlier than usual. He'd done his job properly, but at the end of the day, it didn't matter, did it? Failure was still failure, even if it wasn't his fault. The barman didn't even ask him what he wanted anymore. He just nodded at him and poured his beer. He'd become a regular. "Hey," a woman said as he emptied his first glass. "Don't I know you?" He was about to shrug, to shake his head, to tell her that no, she didn't. He glanced at her and the words died on his lips. "Yeah, I know you," she said brightly. "You? We went to the same school, right?"
"Deborah?"
he asked, not believing. Was it really the same girl? The lovely, pure girl he'd fantasized about in all those long classes. Same lips, same nose. But that was where the similarity ended. She was almost skeletal, her cheekbones protruding sharply. Her hair, once a cascade of curls, was a tangled mess, looking almost sticky. Her skin had a strange tone to it, oily. And her eyes, they were so dull. "That's right," she smiled, happy to be recognized. It probably didn't happen too often. "Have you been?" It took him a few seconds to figure out she didn't know his name, which was no big surprise. He bought her a beer and casually mentioned his own name as he told her a dumb story about a letter that he'd gotten from school. He saw the relief in her sunken, dead eyes when she caught it. Didn't have to skirt around it in her conversation, calling him babe and dude. She was impressed when he told her what he did, and it made him feel better about himself. When he asked her what she'd been doing, mentioning he'd heard that she was in California, she looked away. She talked vaguely about a good job she had there, and an asshole boyfriend. But now, apparently, she was done with both the job and the boyfriend, and California as well. "I was actually just about to get on a bus," she said. "Maybe tonight."
"A bus where?"
She shrugged. "Who knows? Somewhere far. I need to start again. Clean slate, you know?"
"Yeah."
"What I really need," she said, "is some time to think." His body clenched as if she'd kicked him in the gut.
"I know exactly what you mean."
His voice cracked and he stuck a hand in his pocket. The plastic bag almost felt hot to his touch. He'd bought it a few months earlier and carried it around, thinking of it as just one more fantasy. He never believed he'd have the courage to use it. He opened it, sliding out one round pill into his palm. She had to go to the bathroom a few minutes later, perhaps to avoid the apparent lull in conversation. When she was gone, he took his hand from his pocket, palming the pill. He glanced around, already drenched in sweat. No one was looking. One quick move and the pill was in her half-finished glass. It seemed to take forever for it to dissipate into nothing. Any moment, the barman or one of the people around him would ask and point at the fizzing pill. but no one did. She was half out of it by the time he told her he'd give her a ride to the bus station. She confessed she didn't have money for the bus, and he shoved a $100 bill into her hand, which she took without complaining, stuffing it into her pocket, clearly used to taking money from men she hardly knew. Her eyelids were half closed within seconds of her entering the van. She never even noticed the crate in the back, the digging implements. For a moment, he considered dropping the whole thing. His heart thumped so loudly it almost sounded as if it were plugged into the van's stereo system. But his mind was already in high gear, imagining the act. And she'd asked for it. He drove them to the nearest location. It was dark, of course, but he knew the way. He stopped the van a few yards from the pit's location. He got out, taking a small LED light and a shovel with him, and walked to the pit, finding the mark he'd left there. He shoveled off the sand from the pit's cover and removed it. Just looking at its yawning, dark abyss made a shiver run through his body. This was actually happening. He opened the back of the van and pulled the crate out. He dragged it through the sand, already regretting not parking the van closer, its back pointed at the pit. Next time, he thought, and it startled him. There wouldn't be a next time. This was a one-time thing. Then he strode to the front side of the van, opening the passenger's door. He unbuckled her seatbelt, smelling her as he leaned across the body. She smelled of perfume and rot, and he shuddered. She muttered as he helped her out, and he half-cajoled her, half-dragged her to the crate. It had always seemed like a huge crate to him, but now that he needed to push her into it, he realized how small it was. Why had he never searched for anything bigger? Because he never really thought she'd go through with it. He began shoving her inside. She muttered angrily. He pushed harder. She started to resist, but he forced her with all his strength. She shouted faintly, but there was no one around to hear. She scratched him, whimpering, and he gave her one final shove. She fell inside, hitting her head, crying. He closed the box just as she reached out to grab the edge, and the wooden lid hit her fingers. She cried again, pulling the fingers away. He latched it shut. Pulling the crate into the pit in the darkness was the hardest thing he'd ever done, and he almost fell inside himself as he did it. When it finally tumbled inside, he heard her muffled shriek. He was breathing hard from the effort and the excitement. Shoveling the soil on top of the crate, he quickly saw the problem. There wasn't enough soil around to cover it easily. He should have brought soil with him. Stupid, stupid. Instead, he shoveled soil from all around, trying to keep the surface uniform so that it wouldn't look strange come morning. He used large rocks lying around to fill the empty space, and they landed on the crate with a loud thud, eliciting more screams. He worked hard, not daring to stop. Soon he couldn't hear her screams anymore, and he regretted it. He wished he could still hear her. He wished he could see her terrified face as she thumped on the lid. But of course, that was impossible. And then it was covered. He was about to explode. He needed release. It took only seconds, and the feeling that followed, that complete, wonderful nothingness, was the best thing he'd ever felt. He stared ahead at the dark, empty road, the silhouette of the closed gas station, the starry sky. He wondered how Deborah was using her time to think. His eyes focused on the gas station. He hadn't been worried about it earlier. It was closed. But now it hit him. What if there was a security camera there? It would have night vision capabilities for sure, and if, by chance, it was aimed at where he was. He swallowed. How had this never occurred to him before? And the answer came to him again, because he'd never really thought he'd go through with it. He considered digging Deborah up, telling her it had been just a joke. He'd drive her to the bus station, put her on a bus to New York. The woman was a drug addict. No one would believe a word she said. But they might. And if there was footage? Oh, God. He could destroy the footage. No way this gas station paid for some fancy cloud storage for their footage. Their security cameras would be hooked to a computer inside. All he'd have to do was break a window, walk in, and delete the footage, and he'd be done. Among all his gear, he had a ski mask, and he always had gloves with him. He rummaged for his toolbox. Break a window, get inside, delete the footage. It would only take 2 minutes. and he'd be safe. Chapter 75. Dale City, Virginia. Monday, September 12th, 2016. Andrea woke up with a start, knowing that something she'd heard had jarred her out of her sleep, but she wasn't sure what. Then it came again. A knock on the door. She frowned at the clock. 11:30, what the hell? She got out of bed, padding barefoot to the living room. Someone knocked on the door again. A polite knock, unhurried. Yeah?
Ma'am, I'm Officer Browning from downstairs.
The voice came, muffled, official.
We got a report of a stranger in your building. Are you all right?
There's no one here. The door was locked.
Are you sure, ma'am? A neighbor said she saw someone climbing the emergency stairway. Do you want me to have a look around?
Andrea's heart froze. The emergency stairway was just outside her bedroom window. She was sure it was latched, but... A terrible image of Rod Glover sliding through the window, hiding under her bed, waiting like a child's nightmare. There's a monster under the bed, Mommy.
Hang on.
She considered getting a robe, but it was in her bedroom, just next to the window, and the emergency stairway. Officer Browning would have to deal with her tank top and bralessness. She shuffled to the door, glancing through the peephole. The uniformed officer stood by the door, his face turned away from the peephole as he watched around him impatiently. She unlatched the door, unlocked it, and pulled it open.
Come in, but...
He turned to face her, and her world shifted, shattering. The threat no longer behind her, no longer imagined. His hand shot forward, grabbing her throat, squeezing, and the scream that hurtled up her throat came out strangled, croaky, weak. Glover took a step inside the house, kicking the door closed behind him. He was dressed in a cop's uniform, but his sneer was as far from a law officer's expression as anything.
Hello, Andrea,
he hissed. He put a knife to her cheek, just inches below her eye, and pressed it, letting the tip puncture the skin lightly.
Don't struggle, or Zoe will have a one-eyed sister. Don't scream, don't do anything. You got that? Blink if you do.
Andrea blinked, terrified. Her lungs spasmed as she tried to breathe, her mouth opening and closing desperately.
Here's the good news,
Glover said.
I want you alive. I want Zoe to see the fear in your eyes when she gets back. I want her to feel like the shitty sister she is, leaving you all alone. So if you just stay still, we'll be done in no time. You got that?
Another blink and a tear. Even if she wanted to struggle, she couldn't. Her muscles felt like butter. Spots were dancing in her vision, her lungs burning for air. His grip slackened, and she managed to take a wheezing breath.
Let's go to the bedroom,
he suggested. He stepped forward slowly, and she had to stumble backward to keep pace. A thought struck her. He knew where he was going. He moved calmly, his eyes already flicking to the right door, as if he had learned the apartment's layout by heart. She let out a sob.
Shh!
Step, step. One hand on her throat, the other with the knife, dancing in front of her left eye, the tip almost close enough to touch, forcing her to shut her eyes.
Open your eyes. Walk.
And then, just as they passed the guest room, the door opened. Glover didn't seem to realize, his eyes focused on his destination and on Andrea's terrified face. Marvin stepped out, looking confused, his eyes locking with hers. She saw the understanding there. He began moving when Glover whipped around, fast as a snake. He slammed Andrea against the wall, the hand with the knife darting forward, stabbing Marvin's chest. Marvin gasped, his eyes glazing, and Glover punched him in the face, emitting a crack. Marvin stumbled back, falling, head hitting the doorknob. Blood pooled almost instantly on the floor by his lax body.
No!
Andrea let out a scream, and the knife was back at her eye.
Interesting bodyguard you had here,
Glover hissed. Fury filled his eyes.
For this surprise, I'll give you something to remember me by when we're done.
He pushed her hard to the bedroom, his movements rougher than before, his face hard, angry, his teeth bared in an inhuman snarl. He whipped her around, and it was almost a relief not being able to see his face. He pushed her hard against the bed. There were a few seconds of nothingness, and then a cloth clenched around her throat. She remembered what Zoe had told her. Glover had a fixation with strangling his victims. She wasn't going to make it. Even if he really intended to keep her alive, he wouldn't be able to control his urges. He'd rape her and strangle her to death, just like he had with every other victim. But now it was too late to do anything. The cloth bit into her throat, and she had no air. Her fingers clawed at the noose while Glover ripped her pants, muttering curses, growling, noises he made more bestial than human. An image popped into her mind from her childhood. Locked in the room, Glover pounding at the door and Zoe hugging her, protecting her. But her sister was thousands of miles away now. She faded into unconsciousness, the dark oblivion welcoming. But then the cloth around her neck shifted, its grip lessened by a fraction, and she could draw a quick breath of air. That was also something Glover did. He knew how to keep his victims alive and conscious till the end. She inhaled his smell, and it was rank, sweaty, unclean. She struggled, not wanting this thing to touch her anymore. He laughed, pushed her face into the mattress, his fingers on her skin, groping, probing. An explosion. It made her ears ring, and she let out a terrified scream. The cloth had disappeared from her throat, and she could scream freely now, over and over, as much as she liked, and she did. She turned around, seeing the blurry shape of Marvin standing inside the room, leaning against the wall, a gun in his hand. She searched for Glover, glimpsed him in the corner, holding his side, grimacing. His predatory eyes locked on Marvin, and indecision flickered in his gaze. Another explosion roared as Marvin shot again, a shattering as the window broke, and she knew he'd missed. He was dazed and weak from blood loss. Glover would realize this, would pounce on him, kill the old man in seconds. But he didn't. She saw fear in his eyes now, the fear of a monster used to easy prey, unaccustomed to pain. The fighting had caught him by surprise. He lunged forward, not for Marvin and the gun, but for the door. Marvin moved, tried to get a third shot, but Glover was already out of the room. For a moment, none of them moved. Then Marvin stumbled to the floor, still gripping the gun hard. Chapter 76. Zoe sat on her bed, pages scattered all around her. Some were photos of the crime scene, others were handwritten summaries of what she could glean about Deborah Miller. She had a feeling that Deborah was more significant than the other victims. She was different. No Instagram or Facebook account, as far as Zoe could tell, so the killer hadn't stalked her like the others. And of course, she was older than the killer's other victims. Something about her had prodded him into action. What was it? Had she reminded him of someone he knew? Maybe his mother? Or maybe something had attracted him in her appearance? Deborah's father said she looked worse than ever before. Understandably, he didn't have a picture from that time, but Zoe could make educated guesses. She was probably thin, bad skin and teeth, broken fingernails, nervous tics. Maybe this was what had made the killer act. She was doing her best to avoid thinking about it from Deborah's perspective. That was a rabbit hole she didn't want to go down into. Of all the victims, she estimated that Deborah had suffered the worst. Her phone rang and she let it ring for several seconds, her attention elsewhere. Then she fumbled for it, still reading her notes. Hello? For a second, all she heard was a shuddering breath, and Zoe's focus sharpened. Andrea?
Zoe, can you please come home?
What's wrong? She was weightless in a pool of anxiety. What happened?
Glover broke into the apartment. He attacked me.
Are you hurt? Zoe was already off the bed, grabbing her bag, throwing everything at hand inside it. It seemed impossible. Why would he attack now? She was so sure he'd wait for them to lower their guard. He'd always been so patient.
Yes. No, I don't know. There's a paramedic here. Marvin shot Glover.
Marvin shot Glover? Where were the police? Is Glover dead? She needed more information. Where were her damn shoes?
Please, come home. Please, I need you, Zoe. Please just get here. I need you now. Come home. Come home.
Andrea's voice rose, becoming hysterical. In the background, she heard a stranger's voice saying that he needed a sedative. Andrea, I'm on my way, okay? I'm on my way right now. Her sister sobbed on the other side. Just a series of hiccuping whimpers, each of them tearing at Zoe's heart like a serrated blade. And then the line went dead. Zoe's shoes were in the bathroom. She put them on, mind blank, each action automated, her movements feeling jerky, unreal. She grabbed the bag on her way out, vaguely aware that she'd left some things behind, not caring. She half walked, half ran to the stairs before realizing she couldn't get home to Andrea by running. Her mind scrambled for answers, came up with the best solution she could think of, and she turned around, hurried to Tatum's door and banged on it.
Tatum, open up!
He did, wide-eyed and confused, gun in hand, as if he expected to shoot someone, which perhaps made sense considering her screaming.
What happened?
Glover attacked Andrea. I need to fly back. Give me the car keys. Tatum frowned at her, and she nearly hit him to get him to move.
Car keys, now!
Is she all right?
He asked, stepping back into his room.
She's alive. I don't know anything else. Marvin, short Glover.
What? Is Marvin okay?
He asked her some other things, words coming out of his mouth. She was unable to connect them into sentences in her mind.
I don't know,
she screeched at him.
Give me the fucking keys.
He located the keys in his jacket's pocket, pulled them out, said something else she didn't catch, something about how she intended to get there.
I'll drive to Austin. There are planes flying from there all the time, she said, snatching the keys from his hand.
He turned around, bolting for the door. Behind her, Tatum was talking, calling her, but she couldn't turn back. There was no time. Andrea's screams were still ringing in her ears, yanking her onward toward Virginia. Chapter 77 Tatum watched Zoe disappear into the darkness and turned back to his room, shocked. He'd never seen her like this. Her eyes, always so sharp and keen, had been glazed in a look of abject fear. Her face had been wet with tears she hadn't even seemed to notice. Shaking himself from his torpor, he lunged for his phone, dialed, waited impatiently as the phone rang once, twice, three times. Marvin answered.
Tatum? Marvin, are you all right?
I shot him, Tatum. I shot the bastard. He was messing with the wrong guy.
Why are you talking like that?
He broke my nose, Tatum, but I shot him.
In the background, someone said,
Sir, please put that gun down.
Like hell I will, Marvin shouted. What if he comes back? Who's gonna shoot him? You?
Sir, if you don't put the gun down, I will have to.
You stay away from me.
Marvin,
Tatum shouted into the phone.
What's going on?
They want the gun, Tatum. I'm not giving it up.
Watch where you're waving that thing, old man,
someone said sharply.
Marvin, give the cops your gun,
Tatum gritted his teeth.
No way, Tatum. Who's gonna look after Andrea if I do that? The fish?
Tatum massaged his forehead, heart thumping.
Let me talk to the officer.
Here. My grandson wants to have a word. He's from the FBI.
A moment of silence and then another voice on the phone.
Hello. This is Special Agent Gray, Tatum said. Who's this? I'm Officer Collier. Are you this man's grandson?
Yes. What's going on there, officer?
Listen, Agent, you need to tell your crazy grandfather to put that damn thing down. He nearly shot us when we came inside, and he doesn't seem too stable.
Don't worry, he won't shoot anyone.
Tatum fervently hoped he was right.
What about Andrea? Is she all right?
She's in shock, but mostly unhurt. The paramedics are looking after her. But if your grandfather won't put the gun down, he'll bleed to death.
Bleed to death?
He was stabbed. The paramedics won't get near him. He's acting like a loon. He's probably in shock.
No, that's his regular behavior,
Tatum said.
Put me on speaker. Okay, hang on.
A second later, there was a crackle as Tatum was presumably put on speaker.
Marvin, he called.
Yeah, Tatum, what's up?
I need you to give the officer the gun.
I don't think so, Tatum. I need this gun to shoot that bastard if he comes back.
How is it that even bleeding to death with a broken nose, this man managed to be so infuriating? Tatum almost screamed at him, but he knew that would only make the old man dig his heels farther into the ground.
Okay, listen. Can you get...